Well, good evening, everyone. This is Pam Stack, your host, and you're listening to Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm so glad you're with me tonight. One of the most talented men it has ever been my pleasure to speak to is with me tonight, Max Allen Collins. I have tried and tried to think of how would I ever create this episode and have the space to put all the things he's ever done. Impossible. I would have to use like 5 pages worth to write everything down that Max has done. So instead of doing that, I will tell you that not only does he write fantastic novels, he's got a great PI novel. He's written graphic novels. Certainly you've heard of The Road to Perdition, which is made into a Tom Hanks Academy Award-winning film, and he wrote the novelization for that. He's written and sequels to them also. He's written for DC Comics, Dick Tracy. He wrote Ms. Tree, his own Ms. Tree, longest-running private eye comic book, Batman, Crime Scene, CSI Crime Scene Investigation. He's written novelizations. He was a very good friend with Mickey Spillane, who happened to be his son's godfather, and he now writes for that estate. He has a one-man show called Elliot Ness, An Untouchable Life, which was nominated for an Edgar. He's done tons of other television. He's got a Cinemax show starting this coming up in a week or two that we're going to talk to him about. He is also a musician, has his own band, and is in the Iowa Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It is just an absolute delight to introduce Max Allen Collins. Max, welcome to Authors on the Air. Thank you for being with me tonight.
Well, it's my pleasure. Go ahead and talk about all the stuff I've done for another half hour or so. I'm fine with that.
I know. I need about a half hour to read through all this. It's amazing. I posted it on the show website, and it almost turned into one of those notes that you have to tuck away because there's just so much on there. So before the show, you and I were talking, and you mentioned the most recent thing that's happening in your life, and that is Cinemax. Let's start off talking about what's happening on Cinemax.
Well, it's pretty interesting because it's a show called Quarry, which is based on a series of books that I'm still writing. And the first book appeared in 1975. So this has been bizarre that this came back after all these years. I began it at the University of Iowa Writers Workshop in 1972, I believe. And then all these years later, interest has stirred back up, and I'm now, well, I wrote 4 of the books in the 70s, and I was in my 20s, and I wrote 4 books, paperback originals, and they, the publisher didn't ask for any more, so I went about my business and did other things, and then a little bit of a cult grew up about this particular character, who is a hitman. I was the first hitman to basically be the hero or anti-hero of a series. And in the 80s, there was enough interest that I wrote one more and then, again, kind of forgot about it. Then in the early 2000s, I got the opportunity to do one more for a company called Hard Case Crime. And I thought, this is really interesting because I have the opportunity to end a series for once. I can end it. So I called the book The Last Quarry, and it was the last story about this particular character. And then it was very popular and got really good reviews, and I thought, what have I done? I've written myself out. So I...
You pinned yourself into the proverbial corner there.
Absolutely, and I went to my editor, Charles Ardai at Hard Case Crime, and I said, I think we should do another one. And he said, so do I, but what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to do a book called The First Quarry. And so I went back to the beginning of his career. And what I've been doing ever since, I've done about half a dozen of them, are basically period pieces in the 70s and 80s about the character, writing him in the era that in which he was created. So I guess I've lived long enough now to see my contemporary series become historical novels. So it's a whole different thing where I'm actually have to kind of research. If I said it in 1975, I have to kind of go back and research 1975 because I don't remember what I was doing in 1975.
Right.
So so that's been a fascinating thing, and it's just out of nowhere the TV show happened. There was a movie a couple of years ago, I call it an art house indie crime movie that I wrote, and it did pretty well. It was called The Last Lullaby, and so we'd already had some interest, but this is kind of the big time. I love it. The first time I've had a TV series based on anything I've done.
Well, actually, you'll be able to play out a lot more of the story, especially since you've had to go back now and dig into the 70s, the 80s, and everything else. So now it will play out on the small screen at home, which is wonderful for you. Because I know that you've had your fingers in documentaries and movies and other things like that. So this is your first television show. When does this begin? When is your debut show?
The show starts September 9. It airs at 10 o'clock on the coasts and at 9 o'clock in the Midwest. But, it's Cinemax, so they show it, I think, about 10 or 11 times. During the month. But one of the things along the lines of what you were mentioning that has been gratifying is when, in other situations when people have approached me about this particular character, who is a hitman character and is a kind of a genre character, usually they want to do it modern day. And, I'm willing to license my work to let somebody go do something and, underwrite what I do. But this time, these people came to me and said they wanted to do it in 1972. They wanted to do it as a period piece. So they are doing it as a period piece, even as I now am doing it as a period piece. So it all feels kind of right. And, of course, the theme of it always was very strongly a war in Vietnam theme. He's a combat veteran. He's a combat veteran who comes back, and his wife was unfaithful, and he does something bad to the person she was unfaithful with, and he becomes gradually drawn into this world of contract killing. And there was a kind of, not to be pretentious about it, but there was a theme about Vietnam and about the whole idea of how numb we had all gotten to violence in those years. How matter of fact, I always say we were, you'd be watching TV, eating off a TV tray, eating a TV dinner,
TV tray.
TV on the news, they'd be loading up helicopters with body bags, and we're just sitting there, It's just kind of rolling over us, and that was, in some respects, something I wanted to touch on there. A little dangerous doing the hitman as a hero, because they're in the first person, and you're kind of challenged to, as a reader, to say, can I handle this? And I tend to always do something. I do something pretty rough usually at the beginning of each story so that I can say, look, this is, if you want to get off the bus, this is probably, you should probably take the next stop. And if they stick around, then, they're kind of not nasty books. I actually think the books are very moral, but some people misread that character as a sociopath, and I see him as very much not a sociopath. I see him very much as just a normal person who circumstances have turned and twisted. I want him to be as much like us as I possibly can.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you. I mean, I think I like the anti-hero as much as the next person, but Max has a little bit of a cough. He's getting over a cold, so we'll...
Did you hear that? I'm sorry.
Yeah. No. Don't worry about it. I'm just explaining you have a little bit of a cough, so we want to just, we're giving a wide berth here. I think your anti-hero, though, in this character... I think he feels justified in some ways, and I like that. I like the fact that, there's moral ambiguity, of course, but better than that, you write it in first person. And so I think that really gives the reader an insight into your character, your main character. And it can't, you know, rather than standing off and telling his story, you're inside his head and we see through his eyes. It's a very interesting way. It's a provocative way to tell a story, quite honestly. And one that
well, yeah,
I don't
imagine. You're rooting for him. I mean, you have no choice. If you've taken the ride,
right.
You've got to root for
right.
him. And once there comes a point in the story, any Corey story, where I really do want you to question, just who have I been identifying with here? Why was it so easy for me to identify with this person who does terrible things?
Right.
I should also say the books are very funny, which is one of, you know, one of the saving graces. The books, to some degree, I consider the books splat comedies. And it's a place where that kind of dark humor can come
in.
In
other words, his sense of humor is a very off, or it's, you know, sarcastic, witty, that type of a thing, you mean?
Yes, but also that he can do something that he thinks is quite justified. And you can see that it's not justified, and you see the dark humor of that, you know, that justification. I mean, he's all about rationalizing. I mean, he basically
right.
anybody that he murders is already marked for murder. And he says they're, you know, they just haven't written the obituary yet. They're already dead, and that's kind of how he deals with it. And of course, he felt that, you know, he feels that. He was killing people in Vietnam for no reason, and when he got home, he killed a man for a reason, and that was the only time he got in trouble. So that seemed to him to not make sense, much as I think the war in Vietnam did not make sense to a lot of people.
I can actually relate to that exactly. How many episodes are you committed to initially, or have they committed to you initially?
They've done eight. I've seen all eight, and I every season I get to write one. That was part of my deal, and so and I've actually written one for season two, but season two is not absolutely a sure thing. It's
sure.
pretty common for them to, you know, commission the scripts for the second season, in to see if the show is successful. They've got to be ready to go on that next season.
Exactly.
So I'm obviously crossing my fingers because I'd really like to see that second script I wrote shot. So
I bet you would. How exciting for you. So now, do you think that you're going to try to maybe look for other television projects like that?
Well, yes. I mean, we have had a lot of interest in, you know, because I've been doing this a long time. I have a number of,
yeah.
and this is a crass way to put it, but I have a number of properties. And so, you know, we make people in Hollywood aware of what's available. So there are a couple of things kind of brewing right now, but boy, it's, you know, over the years, I probably have had 20 or 25 options on my material. And there have
right.
only been, you know, three things made, except for a couple of things I made myself as independent films. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty, you know, you mentioned Road to Perdition. I have
right.
no illusions about it. I won the lottery with that. I was incredibly, incredibly lucky to have that, all of those pieces, all of those stars align. You know, from my perspective, many of the things I had written before Road to Perdition were as good or better and could have made great, big, wonderful movies, but that didn't happen. But the stars aligned on this one.
Interesting that I'm speaking to you today after listening to you last week on NPR. We'll talk about that movie novelization. And then today on Fresh Air, Tom Hanks is on, and he talked a little bit about Road to Perdition, too. So you know, it
really?
Was meant to be that I was speaking to. Yes, I'm really convinced that it was meant to be. Apparently, they were replaying an interview he did last April, and he was talking about all the different roles that he had done. Started off, he was afraid he was going to get boxed in to playing the, you know, kind of goofy guy, like the guy in Big mm-hmm. and all that, and, you know, things changed for him. But he did mention Road to Perdition. I want to stay in the 70s right now because you also wrote the Dick Tracy comic strip beginning in 77. How did that come about for you?
Well, that was my first.
I love that. That
was my big break.
That comic strip.
That was my big break. I got to be careful because we could do an hour on this, and I'll condense it way down. But I had been Dick Tracy had been my obsession as a kid. I loved Dick Tracy. Yeah, I collected the comic books and had scrapbooks of the strips, and it really was my obsession. And anybody who knew me knew I was into Dick Tracy. This was from age about 7 to 12 or 13. You know, before I discovered rock and roll. And I even looked, my mom, I think it was for my 8th birthday, she went to the creator of Dick Tracy, Chester Gould, and she wrote him and asked him to send me, if he would send me a birthday card. And Chester Gould actually wrote me drew a beautiful picture of Dick Tracy and sent it to me, and it came on my 8th birthday. And my mom had sent some, because I initially wanted to be a cartoonist, and my mom had sent some some Dick Tracy pictures that I drew to Chester Gould, and Chet wrote back and said that I drew Dick Tracy better than anybody my age in the whole country. Now that little pat on the back, it's hard to imagine how much that did for me. And as I look back at that, I think that's where it started for me. Was him?
How wonderful!
Encouraging me that way, and then when I got, you know, when I first got published, I sent him the books. We renewed our, because he had written me several times when I was a child, and then as a young man, I had renewed a correspondence with him, and then we started to, you know, he invited me to his office at the Tribune, and I went to his home a number of times, and we just became friends, and it was just amazing, because we'd be sitting there, and he'd be telling me what the next Dick Tracy story was going to be. Now, he's, at this point, is well deep into his 70s, and ultimately, I got a phone call, because a lot of people think, because he and I were friends, that's how I got the strip. But that isn't the case. I got a phone call from the editor at the Tribune Syndicate, and asking me if I would try out for the strip. They were doing a kind of a talent hunt. And I asked him how he got my name, and he had actually talked to my literary agent. He'd found out I'd written a couple of mystery novels that had a lot of references to comics, that I'd written articles about comics. So they were looking for a mystery writer who knew something about comics, and someone who was cheap, which I was at that point, and they gave me this opportunity. And I will brag about this. There are a bunch of people contacted, and when I did my proposal overnight, and of course there was no FedEx then, I sent it special delivery. Remember, special delivery.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So they had it on their desk in Chicago in 2 or 3 days, and you know, a big, pretty elaborate proposal. And they called off the talent hunt, called me to Chicago. And I remember sitting in this hotel room in Chicago with the president of the Tribune Company Syndicate and the editor-in-chief of the Tribune Company Syndicate. And I think I'm getting kind of a job interview. And a lot of people, you know that situation where you're in a job interview and at some point halfway through you realize, no, I have this job. They're asking me what I'm going to do with this job, not what I would do with this job. What are you going to do? And boy, that was something. And so,
how amazing.
Yeah, we drove back to Muscatine, Iowa, where we still live. But I remember we stopped and ate at McDonald's. And I remember sitting at McDonald's. That's sort of how we celebrated that I got my big break. And so I did it for 15 years. I had two different artists.
Did you do the drawings as well as the text?
No, I wanted to be a cartoonist. I wanted to be one. I had, this is a related kind of a related thing. I was doing a lot of my homemade comic books in junior high. I'd draw it and I'd pass it around. People
mm-hmm.
would read them and encourage me. And then, but I, about that time, Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler,
mm-hmm.
and Mickey Spillane.
Mm-hmm.
And a myriad number of other lesser but wonderful writers of what they then called hard-boiled fiction and what everybody calls noir
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
And also at the same time on TV, there was a craze for Private Eyes. So Peter Gunn
yeah.
was on, 77 Sunset Strip was on, there was a Mike Hammer TV show, there was a Thin Man TV show, and those, so the Mike Hammer TV show led me into the books, the Thin Man TV show led me into Dashiell Hammett, there was actually even a Philip Marlowe TV show that led me to Chandler, and so I became obsessed with the writing end, so the drawing just kind of fell aside, but I never lost
no,
my
I
love
did.
For comics or my interest in comics.
I was never allowed to read comic books when my brothers and I were kids. We were just not allowed to read comic books. I have no idea why. We read books, but we were not allowed to read comic books. And as a matter of fact, I really didn't have any interest, but I do remember that it was the syndicated strip that would come every day with the newspaper, and I remember reading it then and loving it because it was so, you know, the two-way wristwatch
right.
and the with the thing in it, you know, all of that stuff. I was fascinated by it, fascinated
it was very
by
imaginative.
It. And at that time, yeah, it was very, very, very forward-thinking for the time. Now, you also wrote for Batman, too, didn't you?
Yeah, the Dick Tracy strip, like I said, I did it for 15 years. And during that period, particularly early on, I attracted a lot of attention in the world of comics because people loved that strip and they thought I was doing a good job. So I got a chance to do Batman for a year. And it was not a very successful run. I did it for a year. We're very popular in, this is kind of funny, we're very popular in Toys R Us. I was kind of proud of this because this was right around the time where they're starting to do Batman very dark, very dark.
Yes.
For grown-ups. And, you know, I grew up on, I guess, the silly Batman. But, I mean,
yes.
I didn't think it was silly, but what other people would, you know, well, grown-ups would think was silly. You know, the stuff that when they did the TV show, they really were doing the comic books. And
yes.
all they had to do was do them straight and it would be funny. And that's why that show worked, because if you were 30 or 35, it was hilarious. If you're 8 or 9, it was thrilling, and that was the genius
yes.
of that TV show. And I came aboard at Frank Miller had already done The Dark Knight, and I came aboard and I did a very traditional Batman. I think my comic book Ms. Tree was a very dark comic book. And I think they thought mm-hmm. that I would come to Batman and be that dark. You know, in Ms. Tree, the artist Terry Beatty and I, we did, you know, we did abortion clinics getting blown up. We did, you know, models and, you know, actresses in pornography killing themselves. Just all kinds of contemporary and very dark things. But I didn't think that was what you did with Batman. Batman was a hero to me, and so I wrote him very straight, and a lot of the readers at that time did not like that. But the funny thing is that Toys R Us decided that they wanted to put some Batman comic books in, because the movies were doing really well, and they were going to put them in, I guess they were going to put them in little plastic bags. So they came in, and they read the last 10 years of Batman comic books, and what they selected to put in Toys R Us were all of my issues, and so
they didn't
and then on the one hand, I've got a lot of these fans who are big, very critical, and they still are to this day because they have long, long demented memories. But I had huge royalty checks off of those issues because they were, if you can imagine how many Batman comics you could sell in a Toys R Us, in the mid-80s. So anyway, so it's just funny the way these things work out.
Now, you also wrote a comic strip based on CSI, Crime Scene Investigation.
Yeah.
The TV series. So, but also, you've written video games, you've done jigsaw puzzles, and more. You have done so much with things that have been so popular. How in the world did it come to be that you did video games and jigsaw puzzles? Because that's fascinating to me.
I was doing a lot of tie-in of it. They're called tie-ins, and I had done several things. I'd done NYPD Blue novels and several things. And they came to me to do the first CSI novel, and they were just very happy with it, and it sold like crazy. And then what really kind of evolved was, for about 5 years, because I had proven myself, I was the sole licensing writer for CSI, the first about 5 years of the show. I did 8 CSI novels. I did 2 CSI Miami novels. I think there were 4 video games that I wrote the dialogue and stories for, ton of jigsaw puzzles, and also comic books that were then collected as graphic novels. And yeah, that sounds like a lot, but it was done over a period of 5 years. And it was, you know, it was very good. I know people don't understand sometimes why I did so much tie-in and novelization work. And it is an odd thing about the publishing industry. But I my Nate Heller books, and we're going to talk about one, I think. They wanted me, my publisher there wanted me to do 1 Nate Heller book a year. But they then did not want me writing anything for anybody else. But that one book, from my point of view, didn't really bring in enough income for me, at least what I was satisfied with.
You had to look at it as a business as well as a creative outlet for yourself. So, yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, I'm not a starving artist, Garrett.
Yeah, so you actually were a Thriller Award nominee for You Can't Stop Me. And
right.
You also, now, you and I talked before the show about novelizations. As I mentioned, you were on, you know, I listened to you when you were on NPR last week with Lee Goldberg and several other writers who they were talking about movie novelizations. And at some point in time, I think it was Entertainment Weekly called you the novelization king because you wrote in a lot of these tie-in books and tremendous success with them, reaching the USA Today bestseller list and the New York Times bestseller list. And that's, you know, no small feat there. But you wrote for some really exceptionally fine movies, the novelization.
I did.
For Saving Private Ryan, for Air Force One, American Gangster, all very well done films. I don't know, though, that listeners completely understand what a novelization is. Will you explain that a little bit, please, Max?
Well, you know, it's complicated because years ago, like in the, you know, going way back, but particularly in, let's say, the 60s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, before VCRs, before, you know, home video, a movie was gone. You saw the movie, and it was gone. When you went to the theater, and if it was James Bond, maybe next year they'd come back with a double feature and you get a chance to see it again. Maybe they'd show it on TV, cut up with commercials and so on. But the only way if you loved a movie, the only way you could re-experience it was with a movie novel. And a lot of people, of course, a lot of movies are based on novels. I mean, Gone with the Wind, you know, that's kind of a novel. And so people, they actually had advertising campaigns about, you know, read the book, see the movie, or see the movie, read the book. Well, and they would do tie-in editions where, you know, the Gone with the Wind cover of the paperback would be, you know, Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh. Or they would do, you know, like James Bond, and it would be Sean Connery. And so what happens is for some movies, there aren't novels. They're original screenplays. So publishers decided, well, we'll have books made out of the screenplays. But what happens is the book has to be on the stands when the movie is out, which means while they're shooting the movie, you're writing the book, which is pretty tricky because you're using a screenplay and having to imagine what that movie might be. And you have varying amounts of cooperation or not cooperation from the movie people. The average thing is that maybe you get 8 or 10 movie stills, and you've got to just imagine what this movie is. And so it's pretty tricky. But now the art form of it, the art of it, and there is an art to it, or certainly at least a craft, is that you're taking a screenplay, which is basically the blueprint of a film, and films are passive. I mean, you and I talked a little bit about TV and as opposed to TV compared to reading, and you preferring reading to television.
Right.
Well, reading is active.
Yes.
And, you know, so that's the difference. Reading is active. Movies are passive. So a movie is an exterior experience. A novel is an interior experience. So the reimagining of the movie, or in reality the screenplay, is to turn it into a novelistic experience, getting inside the characters, moving the story around through the people, not just pointing a camera at the people. And that's why some novelizations are really, really good.
Wow. Awesome. Really cool. I know that Lee does those. I talked to his brother, Todd. Todd had just written a book with Brad Meltzer, and so he thought we were going to talk about that. And I said, oh, no, we're going to talk about the book she wrote for Burn Notice, because that was my favorite television show. Of course, it was shot in Miami where I lived, and I used to see the set, them filming all over. And he said that he was hired to, when they were off season, he had to produce a story, a Burn Notice story. And so it had nothing to do with the television show other than the characters were the same, you know, use the same location and stuff like that. But it was a completely new way of doing things. So it's interesting to me. Now, one of the conversations you had on NPR last week, as I mentioned earlier, was about your graphic novel, The Road to Perdition, was what is actually turned into the. Do you have anything to do with the script that turned out to be that movie?
Excuse me, I got a cough for a moment. Sorry about that.
No problem. That's all right.
I'm sorry. I feel fine, but the cough has a will of its own.
They do.
I did not. They do what they want to do. I was kept in the loop. I was always shown the screenplays, and then I would give notes. And actually, a lot of my notes had to do with things that I thought were anachronistic, dialogue that I didn't think was appropriate to the period. I didn't really say much about story changes because, as a screenwriter myself, I understand there's a huge difference between a screenplay and its source material. So.
Right.
I stay out of their way on that. If they want my help, I'll give it to them. But
so the film is a huge success. It wins an Academy Award. It's just a phenomenal piece based on a phenomenal graphic novel, which I found very interesting. I did not realize that the book was a graphic novel first.
Yeah.
I thought it was just your novel. I did not realize it was a graphic novel. But nonetheless, earning accolades everywhere. Your name is golden for this. And now they come back to you and they say, we'd like for you to write the movie novelization for Road to Perdition, which is your property to begin with anyway. What happened?
Well, I didn't want anybody else to write it, obviously. It was for DreamWorks. And I'd had a really good experience with DreamWorks on Saving Private Ryan. They allowed me to do anything I wanted to on that book, and I did a lot of research, and I really you know, did a lot of research on the D-Day landing and all of that stuff. And it's a very good historical novel that doesn't begin to be just, just the screenplay regurgitated. It's a real
right.
book. It's still in print. I mean, it's quite well regarded. So I expected
yeah.
going into Road to Perdition, when they've got the creator of the original material, that I could have something of a free hand. Now, what I did was I did not change anything in the script in terms of events, in terms of plot,
right.
or really even in terms
right.
of character. I did, because I don't believe that movie dialogue and book dialogue are the same thing, I did rework
right.
most of the dialogue. And I also used material from the graphic novel, you know, stuff that they had skipped, I drew upon. And the book was 80,000 words. And when I turned it in, they came back to me and said, we don't want anything in here that isn't in the movie. And the dialogue has to be exactly the same as in the script. I never had anybody say that to me on a novelization before. And here it is, my source material.
It seems to me it was like they wanted a transcription of the film, essentially,
right.
is what they wanted. They wanted you to transcribe the film into a book.
Right. And, of course, they didn't have access to the film.
You were just saying, you know, films are passive and books are active. I cannot imagine just having, because that's exactly what it is, a transcript of, someone can get a transcript of our conversation tonight, but it will not be the same is hearing your voice and hearing the intonation or anything else associated with the show. So
what did you do? Well, what I did was, I mean, I did exactly what they told me to do, except with a lot of my extra dialogue, I turned it into interior monologue so that I could retain it. They fought me on it, but at a certain point I said, you know, we're already at 40,000 words. You're going to go down, you get down to 30,000 words, it's going to be a pamphlet. And so finally, they did print it. And I don't think it's bad. I kind of feel like it's the young adult version of the book, of the story. But I'm really pleased
yeah.
to say, and I don't know if you know this, but, and you mentioned Lee Goldberg. Lee Goldberg's company,
right.
Brash Books, is,
yes.
you know, they worked on DreamWorks for about a year to negotiate
yeah.
the rights for me to have my original, complete, 80,000-word Road to Perdition novel published, and it will be out in November. And I can't even believe I'm saying that, because I thought there was no chance it would ever see the light of day.
How wonderful. Congratulations on that. Yeah,
very happy.
Lee and Joel do a good job with Brash, that's for sure. They do a
no
great
question.
Job. I want to skip a little bit now, because
sure.
a great part of your writing and some of your books that I've read remind me greatly of Mickey Spillane, of whom you were very close. You
yeah.
were friends with Mickey. How did that relationship come about? Because it was indeed such a good relationship that Mickey Spillane was your son's godfather, correct?
Yes, this one is hard to condense, but I will shorten this. I mean, I loved Mickey as an adolescent. I mean, from age, well, actually, even all the way up into my early 20s, he was God to me. He was everything I wanted to be as a writer. Now, that's
wow.
not to say that I wasn't a Hammett man, I wasn't a Chandler man, I wasn't a James M. Cain man, or Chester Himes. I mean, I knew all of these writers, and I loved their work. Rex Stout, Agatha Christie, fantastic.
Right.
I like all of these writers.
Right.
But Spillane was special to me. Something about the storytelling power he had, the way he could pull you into a story, particularly his first chapters. And his first chapters and his last chapters are amazing as art and as craft. So I collected him. I got all the first editions and, you know, all of this stuff. And I wrote him probably 100 fan letters. Never heard a word. During this period, he wasn't very active. You know, he didn't write a novel between Kiss Me Deadly in 1952 and a book called The Deep in 1961. There are various reasons which we won't go into, but he basically took about a 10-year sabbatical from the novel field at his peak. This would be like Stephen King writing The Stand and saying, I'll see you in 10 years. It's crazy, but he did it.
Yeah.
So finally, when I sold my first couple of books and I had published, editions, I had copies, I sent him the two books because they came out at the same time. It's about 1973, and he wrote me a beautiful letter, which I framed. And, it's 2 pages. It was in detail. And to sum it up, it was, welcome to the writer's club. Welcome to the community of fiction writers. And just as friendly, that was great. And then I wrote him a number of other times and sent him other books. Never another word, just that one incredible letter. So cut to about 1981, and I get a phone call from the people that were putting on that year's BoucherCon. The BoucherCon, named after Anthony Boucher, the great New York Times mystery critic, is the mystery fan writers convention. Big deal every year. They're having it in Milwaukee. At that time, Mickey was doing those commercials for Miller Lite. And so they went to Miller in Milwaukee and said, would you bring Mickey in? We want him to be our special guest at the BoucherCon. They said yes. He said yes. So I get this phone call, because everybody knew in mystery fiction, knew I was the Mickey Spillane guy, that I wrote, that he defended him, that I wrote, because he was, a lot of people have attacked him over the years, and I defended him, that I wrote articles about him and all this kind of stuff. So they came to me and said, you're the Mickey Spillane guy. Would you be the liaison between the convention and Mickey? And I said, well, absolutely.
Oh,
I would love to.
Oh, my gosh.
And
boy,
so,
did they hand you a plum assignment? Kid in the candy store.
But let me tell you, the night before, there are some stories about Mickey doing crazy things. Like, supposedly somebody sent him the first 6 novels in hardcover for signatures. And supposedly, he then shot them with a .45 and filled them full of holes, did not sign the books, and sent them back to the person. I don't know if that story is true, but I kind of want it to be. you know what I mean? It's just, but the night before
he had
I was going to meet him,
didn't,
I did
didn't
not
he, Max?
Sleep. I was so
did
scared.
You not?
I was so,
that's so
because,
funny.
I didn't.
That's
I
your
didn't
hero.
Want my, I didn't want him to have feet of clay. And everybody has feet of clay. So
yeah.
I was really nervous. So we go to the hotel. The convention guys take me to his room, knock on the door. He's there in the doorway. They say, hi, Mickey. This is Max Collins. And he says, oh, I've known Max. I know Max. We've been corresponding for years. And I said, that's right, Mickey. One letter from 100 letters from me, one letter from you. And
right.
He just beamed, and we were just like best friends from that moment on.
I love the story. I love stories about him too. I remember seeing him when he was being interviewed occasionally. He kind of was he just appeared to be as tough as his characters. He's a very noir character himself. He could have been Mike Hammer himself.
He played him in the movies.
Right. So I can understand how you would be fascinated with him. Now, you now have been tasked with completing a few of his books, but I think I read somewhere that you said you could write 10 more books with the material that he had set aside and never finished.
Yeah, I just signed to do 3 more. And at this point, that will double the number of Mike Hammer novels. He only wrote 13 during his lifetime. I have to bring this story up full circle, without any detail, I would go visit him. A friend of mine and I, James Traylor, wrote a book about him. which was nominated for an Edgar, and we did, he and I did a comic book series together. I did a documentary on him that he cooperated with. He was, again, as you said, my son's godfather. Well, I got a call. I got a call from him, and he told me that he had pancreatic cancer. Now, he'd always been just about the healthiest guy you could even imagine, you know, kind of like a dock worker kind of guy, you know. And, of course, pancreatic cancer is not exactly something you walk back from. And,
no, it isn't.
So we talked, you know, and over the next few weeks we talked. And I knew he was working on a book called The Goliath Bone that he was really excited about on my camera. Well, I get this phone call from him, and he says, "Listen, I don't know if I'm going to get this finished. Do you think if I don't get this finished, would you finish it for me?" And I said, I can't imagine anything, any bigger honor. I said, "I hope you finish it. If you need my help, you know you got my help." And, you know, we left it at that. Although I did tell him that I loved him, and he did tell me that he loved me, so he wasn't that tough. He was a pussycat. He was a pussycat.
How amazing that you developed a friendship because of your admiration for him, and it was a very real, strong friendship. You considered him your family, didn't you?
Well, I did. The thing that bonded us, because obviously I'm of another generation. He was of my dad's generation. I think in part, like, his own sons weren't that interested in writing. So I, you know, obviously was interested in writing. And I would go down there and, you know, we had very different politics. We just never talked politics.
You were smart about that, right?
Yeah. I mean, and it's, yeah, he was very right. I'm somewhat left, and that's just the way it was. And he just accepted that. You know, when I see people fighting over politics now, I think about the fact that he handed my camera to me knowing that I was, you know, had a lot of different views, but he knew I would respect his character and that I would do it the way he would want it done. But I'd go down there to his home in North Carolina, and he and I would just, no, South Carolina. I get the Carolinas mixed up. Anyway, we go down there and we talk into the night. We talk about writing. He didn't have anybody he could talk to about writing. You know, he had friends. He had a guy who was a carpenter. He had a guy who was a dentist and all these. But nobody talked writing to him. I go down there. We would talk the craft of writing. And I'll tell you what, of these books, and I've already done, I think I've done 9 My Cameras now. And a short story collection that's about to come out, all drawn from manuscripts that were unfinished, that were in his files.
What a gold mine! What a gold mine!
About 2 or 3 at least of those books, I knew what the endings were because I would be up in his. He had an office on the 3rd floor of this knotty pine home that he built after a hurricane blew down his other home. And I would sit on the couch, and he would walk around in front of me telling me stories. He told me 3 endings of my camera stories. So these endings were not in writing in his files. These endings were things he told me that I remembered. And I'll tell you what,
Thank God for your memory, Max.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you're sitting on the couch and Mickey Splane is telling you the ending of a My Camera story, you're not going to forget it.
No, I would imagine not.
No.
I would imagine
and he was the most gleeful kid of a storyteller you could ever imagine.
Oh, wonderful. I want to move on to another subject, if you don't mind. You are a very, very accomplished musician. And you have formed a band called Cruisin' in 1974. I want to say that it was the first 60s revival band in the nation, I think you told me. It was an outgrowth of Daybreakers, the mid-60s combo from Dial Records, right? So it seems to me, in reading over your extensive bio, and, you know, I went to Wiki, I went to Amazon, I went to your page, I've read your blogs and all this stuff. The most seminal moments of your life happened in the 70s and 80s. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah.
Things that were really life-altering to you. Yeah.
Yeah, my son was born in the early 80s, and no question. I mean, I have a long, very happy marriage. And my wife Barb and I write together. You know, we write as Barbara Allen. We write a series of cozy mysteries about antiquing. And a lot of that stuff, you know, the Nate Heller books began in the early 80s. In fact, I had written the first Nathan Heller book, and I assume we'll talk about him a little bit. That he's kind of my signature character. I had finished the book, and it was a massive book, True Detective, which is like 125,000 words. And everything about True Detective was not marketable. It was a first-person book, 125,000 words. It was a private eye novel in the first person, 125,000 words. All kinds of rules broken. And so at that point, my wife tells me she's pregnant. And when we find out that it's a boy with the ultrasound, she says, you know, what do you want to call him? I said, I'd really like to call him Nathan. And she said, I would too. I said, but we've got to agree that he only is going to be called Nathan if before you deliver, the book is sold. Because I'm not going to have a little rejection slip running around my house.
That's
what happened. And his name is Nathan. His name is Nathan.
I love that. Is Nathan creatively inclined as you are?
Oh, every bit. He is a Japanese to English translator. So we already have established he's a lot smarter than I am. I'm still working on English. He is quite brilliant. He's in his early 30s. He has written, I say he's written because a translation is a book. He's translated about 7 books.
Wow.
One of them quite famous, which you may have heard of, Battle Royale. He is the translator of the most recent edition of that. And Battle Royale really is where the Hunger Games came from. I couldn't be more proud of him. He's an amazing writer. I wish he would write some of his own stuff, but I think maybe he likes the idea that he's carved creative narrative area that isn't in my world. And I can understand that.
Wow. Well, yeah, he's had to find his own niche, and that's a good thing. But he obviously got the creative gene from you and your wife, so that's a wonderful thing. I guess, you know, we have enough time left, but we really should talk about your association with Forge Books, because you have a book called Better Dead. And I think this is kind of some of your classic writing where you talk about government and espionage and, you know, but it's, again, a little bit historical. And let's talk about this book, Better Dead.
Well, it's one I wanted to do for a long time, and it took me a while to get a handle on it. I should say Nathan Heller, the first books take place in the early 30s. And they kind of, after a while, they kind of jump around. Initially, they were a little bit more linear, but the first about 3 or 4 books really dealt heavily with Chicago. And Capone and Frank Nitti and Elliot Ness and that whole world. And then I never expected the books to go farther than that. I had really only thought there'd be 1 or 2 books, but they kept going. And at a certain point, I decided to look at famous, because part of the idea had always been I would do the private eye in his original era, and I would do it with unsolved famous crimes or controversially unsolved crimes. So, for example, the book Stolen Away is the Lindbergh kidnapping. And, you know, whether or not the book deals with whether or not Hauptmann really was the murderer. And there's a book about Huey Long called Blood and Thunder that deals with his assassination and who maybe really did that. And a lot of research goes into it. In fact, as much as if I were going to do a nonfiction book. This is one, Better Dead is the first time I've really hit the 1950s hard. And I've been wanting to do sort of a Red Scare book. And, I mean, you know, you talked about comic books. And in that era, you weren't supposed to read comic books because they were bad for you. And there were Senate hearings about how bad comic books were for you. It's all part of that McCarthy era craziness. Wanted to do McCarthy. I wanted to do McCarthy, and I had also been thinking about doing the Rosenbergs. But the problem with the Rosenbergs was, unlike a lot of the cases, it's pretty cut and dried what really happened there, particularly after the revelations of more recent years. Now, I think in my research I came up with some aspects of it, some nuances of it that are new. But I felt if I did a book just about the Rosenbergs, it would not be satisfying because I couldn't solve something. Because all of the Heller books tend to solve something.
Right.
You know, the Black Dahlia book I did called Angel in Black, I came up with a new solution for that murder. So that's part of the premise. So I finally got this notion of using McCarthy as kind of the glue for two stories that would be interrelated, but would together, I hope, make a sum the bigger than its parts. So the first half of the book is the Rosenbergs with Roy Cohn and all of that.
Right.
And all of that terrible 50s stuff. And the second part of the book has to do with Dr. Frank Olson, who was suspiciously a suicide, possibly a murder at the hands of the CIA after he was dosed with LSD at a retreat at a CIA retreat. That is a really interesting, fascinating case that isn't terribly well known, but it has some McCarthy connections. It certainly has thematic connections to the Red Scare craziness of that era. And so I linked those two stories together. Some people are viewing the book as two novellas. I don't care how they view it as long as they read it and like it.
There you go. You introduced Dashiell Hammett to Heller in this book. And I think that's fascinating. I love that. I love that you could put that into this type of a book. It just is, it's a very fascinating book, by the way. I hope everybody goes to get that. Better Dead is the name of the book. It's published by Forge. It's the most recent book. And I know you're working on probably tons of other things right now, Max, because it seems to me your brain is not going to be settled until you do multiple projects for multiple years to come. And I hope that that is true, because you certainly entertained several generations now with all the things you've done. And we've only just touched base. We've barely even gotten our finger in the water on this one. Otherwise, I'd have you here every week to do a series with me. And, you know, maybe we ought to do that. Maybe we ought to have you come back and talk about the different things that you're doing and all the different genres that you've been in. I want to ask you, of all the things you've done, and now including the Cinemax program, what have you loved the most? If you could go back and continue doing one project, what would it be?
Well, I would. I'm going to fudge a little bit because I did several independent films and I loved doing them, and I wish I could have done more in my lifetime with film, because I think I'm a good director and I think I'm a good screenwriter, but I didn't want to go to Hollywood, and so that became tough. So that's my one regret, is that I didn't get to do more, but I did do some. The Nathan Heller books, that's to me, that's my legacy. That's what if I'm remembered, what I hope I'll be remembered for. It's a project that means a lot to me. And you mentioned something interesting. If I can tie this in a bit of a bow, you mentioned Hammett being in the current book.
Yes.
It began this way. I was teaching at community college here in Muscatine, Iowa, and I was teaching a mystery write, basically a literature course using mystery novels. And one of them was The Maltese Falcon. And so as a teacher, I reread it. And when I opened it, and I've read it probably 12 times in my lifetime, but when I opened it up and saw the indicia page, I saw that it was copyright 1929. And I had what we call in the comic book business a light bulb moment. And
right.
I said, gee, 1929, that's the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. That means Al Capone and Sam Spade were contemporaries. And I got to thinking about it, and I thought, well, that means that instead of having Philip Marlowe meet an Al Capone type, I can have Al Capone meet a Philip Marlowe type. And then from there I got the notion of using real mysteries, real unsolved crimes. And that's where Nate Heller came from. So Nate Heller, and the epigram in the front of True Detective is a Hammett line. It's from the so-called Flitcraft parable in The Maltese Falcon. So Hammett, I talk Mickey Spillane a lot, but Hammett is extremely important to me.
Well, I think that both of those writers were incredible. And obviously made their mark on your life, but you've really turned it and made it your own, and you have your own style and all. I cannot tell you how much I've enjoyed talking to you tonight. I hope that you'll come back and come back soon, Max, so we can explore some more of the things that you've done and what you hope to accomplish still. Would you do that? Would you be willing to come back?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
I tell you how much fun this has been for me. Thank you so much, Max Allen Collins, for being with me tonight. And you and I will talk again. You've got my number. I've got yours. And we'll email and we'll plan something. I'd love to have you come back and, you know, maybe on a regular basis, once a month, once every other month, come back and, you know, let's talk about stuff because it's so interesting. You have so many, there's so many more things we could explore with you. Okay.
Yes. I'll come back when I'm not coughing though.
There you go. I hope you feel well. Best to your wife and your son. And thank you again, Max. Have a great evening.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. And how about that, folks? Was that not the most interesting conversation you've heard in about a long time? A fabulous man. The new book is Better Dead. On Wednesday, I'm going to be technical support for Jacqueline Machard's Scribe show. And then in the evening, I'll be talking to two fantastic writers. Jess Lurie and Shannon Baker are going to be on. And then on Friday, I'm introducing you to a new fantasy writer, James A. Hunter. It's going to be a great week. I hope you all have a nice evening. Thank you so much. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.